Hello and welcome to the Travel Diaries podcast. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Holly Rubenstein. I'm a travel journalist and editor. And here each week, I'll be speaking to a very special guest about their adventures around the world and the travel experiences and destinations that have shaped their lives. Today, I'm joined by one of the world's most influential and multi-award-winning travel writers, the global editor-in-chief of Condé Nast Traveler, UK and US, Melinda Stevens. Melinda is a trendsetter, a tastemaker, and considered by many to be travel royalty. After beginning her writing career at Vogue magazine, Melinda went on to become a columnist for the Sunday Times and Evening Standard and the travel editor at Tatler before taking the helm at Condé Nast Traveler. Reading Condé Nast Traveler, the way the writers would transport me to far-flung places with the power of their words, was part of my inspiration for becoming a travel writer. So heading to its offices in the heart of London's Mayfair, where the walls were lined with its iconic covers, was really thrilling. Unsurprisingly, Melinda has her finger on the pulse of the hottest destinations, which we of course discuss, as well as reflecting on some of the all-time greats. And she gives a real insight into the makings of a top magazine. So let's hear from Melinda Stevens. This is Wanderlust Guaranteed. Melinda Stevens, welcome to the Travel Diaries. Thank you so much for being here. How are you?
Very well indeed, thank you.
I am so excited because I'm in the holy grail of travel magazine offices at Condé Nast Traveler in your office. So tell me, I am seeing a lot of post-it notes on the wall and postcards lined up. Tell me, what is it that I'm looking at here?
I should have really tidied before you came. I'm seeing it through your eyes and the pot plants and the pterodactyls and the mirrors and the photographs and the books and the bags. And these are the mini boards where the magazine kind of takes shape. That's the UK edition. And then behind me, you'll see the US edition. And then my new collection of mushrooms, which I'm too nervous to take home to my husband.
Oh, I haven't noticed these.
They're fossilized mushrooms that I fell passionately in love with.
Brilliant.
So they're adding to the chaos.
Well, we are going to go on a journey through your life's travel diaries. And I can't wait to kick off. Chapter one is your earliest childhood travel memory. What would that be?
Funnily enough, Frinton on Sea, where I had a wonderful aunt and uncle who used to take me every summer, and this would have been the kind of late 70s when we all used to wear kind of toweling shorts mm-hmm. and little kind of string vests, and it was always raining, and or there was a kind of high wind and you'd be eating a kind of sandy sandwich, and my cousins were all great sportswomen and tennis players mm-hmm. and we would have to do tennis camp, and I had very buck teeth, and I was always put, you know, kind of partnered up with someone who was inevitably much better than I was, and I found it all wildly awkward. But I think those summers, those English summers, when you do those family photographs where you all line up from the smallest child up to the biggest and you're all kind of jostling into one another, mm-hmm. those are my earliest travel memories, funnily enough.
So where actually is Frinton-on-Sea?
Essex. And funnily enough, I haven't been back to Essex since those days, and I probably stopped going when I was about 11.
There's beautiful coastline there.
Amazing, amazing. Yeah. And in fact, a lot of what we do at Condé Nast Traveler, or one of the things that gives me most pleasure in Condé Nast Traveler, is a regular feature we do, which is called staycation. Mm-hmm. Because I think a lot of us have the opinion that in order to travel or in order to experience the world, you have to get on a plane and go to another continent. And that's just not true. And I started out not knowing a huge amount about what we have on our own shores. But the places that we focus in on every month are just amazing. They're amazing independent hoteliers doing wonderful things in wonderful places around the country. And it's very invigorating to know that that's happening.
Yeah. And which stand out to you? Do you have any particular British favourites?
I went to the Long Mynd in Shropshire recently. One of my best friend lives up there, and Shropshire itself is just stunning. You get out of that kind of the flat landscaping of the south, and suddenly you're in these rolling hills. with villages that are kind of very, you know, far from each other. And it's just much more wild. Anyway, we went for a drive and we went for this high. It felt like we were going kind of higher and higher up into the clouds. And it was a beautiful, beautiful summer's day. And we started off on this walk wild. It's kind of heathery and moorlandy and muddy ponies. And, you know, we were stopping and looking for birds nesting and stuff. And I'm a lazy, lazy person. but this walk was just... it just completely opened up my eyes to different parts of England, and I think that keeps happening to me. And the big sky of it was extraordinary. I felt like I was in a kind of snow globe of sky. And then we did this, lots and lots of children tumbling about and dogs. It was quite like that children's story, we're going on a bear hunt. Mm-hmm. We're going to catch, you know, swishy swashy. We were through the grass and through that and through the river. And then we meandered down the hill and ended up in a very sweet pub in Church Stretton and ate cheese and onion crisps and salt and vinegar crisps and pints of cider.
Was travel important to you growing up?
Yes.
Did you have the wanderlust from an early age?
My father and stepmother and mother actually are all big travellers, but I think it was my father and stepmother really who would always go on extraordinary adventures, safari in Africa, and you know, and not staying in swanky hotels. We'd be staying in you know, under tarpaulin with all of those noises in the night, and around the Aegean and the Mediterranean and those shorelines and that colour of the sea. And I think I just always felt that when I was traveling, I was the most of myself. But that really came to fruition when I was 18. And I'm literally never letting my children travel in the way that I do, because my friend Joanna Weinberg and I left school. We thought that we had bought tickets to India. We ended up in Indonesia, and we had like $200 in our pocket for like 6 months. We didn't even know where we were spending the first night. And, you know, and we were pretty closeted kids. We went to a tiny, tiny boarding school in a tiny, tiny village in Wiltshire, which had a tiny, tiny sausage factory in it and nothing else. And then we were on, and then we hired motorbikes. And threw away all our clothes and set off around Bali. Had a motorbike accident on like day three.
She's still
got Honda burned into her leg, and we proceeded to have the most extraordinary adventure of our lives. But I mean, we were 18 and didn't know our left from our right. So,
wow.
But travel was that. That's when I started to feel that I felt almost like my body was changing. The comfortableness of my body in the landscape was shifting, that so that I felt more at ease than I had ever felt. And I think that continues to happen. I do need to be on the move.
Mm. Well, that leads me on to chapter two, which is the first place you fell in love with. What would that be?
So that would have been Bali.
Mm, I wondered.
30 years ago. There was just very little.
Have you been back since?
Yes.
So what was it like then versus now?
Oh, it was, you know, wild. And we got, you know, on that first or second day or third day, we got, after that motorcycle accident, actually, and we got lost in this village. And there was, you know, there were no cars and there was no one driving around. And, you know, we were hurt. And this sweet family came out from behind the trees, and we couldn't speak their language and they couldn't speak ours, and we were trying to communicate with each other, and they started laughing and we started laughing, and then they got huge giggles and we got tremendous giggles. And then I just remember looking around and us being surrounded by this kind of green cornucopia of jungle and wildness, and just our laughter ringing around it. And we ended up spending that night in that village, and we never said a word to each other. It was just through laughter. And I think from then on in, we ended up going to a cockfight in the middle of the jungle. in the middle of a rainstorm, and cockfights even at that point were illegal, so you had to drive into the middle of the jungle to do it. And and it was just us; we were the only two girls, and then I think hundreds of local guys, and these and then the rain starting, and then that being so dramatic. And then we travelled across from Lombok to Sumba, Sumbawa, and then we picked up on a kind of fisherman's boat, and we travelled back through the islands. I'm suddenly remembering there was a hammock, but one night the tarpaulin over us bust, and the rain came in on it, and we were just soaked. God, we stank for months. But in the meantime, I've never seen since actually sunrises or sunsets like they were at that time. So that's when I got the proper bug. And then again, for me, that's what traveling was all about. It wasn't about having very much money. It was a rucksack, not much of a plan. But those are the trips I love the most, the meandering ones with no plan.
So when you travel now, do you have a clear itinerary always in place, or do you like to go with the flow?
Do you know, recently I've done a couple of road trips with my own kids, and they've had a certain itinerary to them, but of course the open road throws up so much that's unexpected. And I think the first one we went on, my little one was only about two, and we just tumbled around in this RV. This was kind of through the northwestern states of America, my brother lives in Seattle, and then we went through Washington to Idaho, and then Wyoming and Montana, and
beautiful wide open spaces.
Such wide open spaces. And then the second trip we did started in Sun Valley, I think, and then we went kind of Utah and Arizona and across to Colorado, down to New Mexico. And America never ceases to amaze me in its kind of undulating wilderness. The wonderland that it is, the geology of the place is just extraordinary.
So extraordinary, and yet I feel that sometimes people don't realise quite how varied and extraordinarily varied the landscape is just from one state to another.
Totally. I think a large part of what I try and do through the magazine is to try and show that as well, that the world is an extraordinary place that's wild and wonderful and unknown, because I think there's so much that's scary and spooky in the world right now. But I feel that my responsibility is to show readers that it's also, I want them to be delighted and I want them to be surprised. And part of that is exactly what you're saying. It's like, where is that place? Like when we did a piece on the Danakil Depression in Ethiopia, where it's so low that the kind of earth's magma lava bubbles up from under it. And the photographer was sending me these alarming pictures of his phone exploding. And that same photographer actually did an amazing piece in the deserts of Sudan. This month we've got a long feature on Kazakhstan. And again, you're just like, these mountains, these vistas, this epicness, this scope. Look at this wonderful place, and let's relish it. It still exists, and I think it should be about wonder, and I think it should be about respect.
Absolutely. So you've said that you fell in love with Condé Nast Traveler at first sight, and you spent your next years grafting at the Sunday Times, Tatler, and the Evening Standard in order to get your dream job.
It's a slight misnomer. I started as a travel editor at Tatler however many years ago, and at that point I'd worked at Tatler on and off for years, and I'd worked for the Sunday Times and the Evening Standard on and off for years, and then this job came up when I was at home, and I was a stay-at-home mum, and I just had a baby, and I was blending food and making my own hummus and writing a really depressing novel, and this job came up as a travel editor at Tatler, and I thought, ooh, that's a bit extreme, but let's give it a shot. And on the first day someone said, what should we do? I'll never forget, what should we do with the story of Marrakesh? And I remember tears coming down my eyes and going, oh my God, this is what I want to do. And on the second day, I worked out that therefore I wanted to be the editor of Condé Nast Traveler, because it was the best travel magazine that there was, and I found my groove.
And then when you got this job, what was it like walking into somewhere that you'd had kind of on that pedestal?
I was so spooked. I was very calm about, I remember Nicholas Coleridge telling me that I got the job, and I thought, God, please, you mustn't be like an X Factor. Hysterical woman, you know. And in fact, when he told me, I was very, very calm and I felt very, very settled, and that was very resonant to me. Anyway, before I actually started the job, I went to try and get a, you know, something to wear for the first day. And then I had a panic attack in Westfield, and my husband had to take the children home whilst I was trying to collect my breath in the changing room of Zara. And then I came in here when I was a mixture of very nervous and very confident, as you are, as you have to be, I don't know.
Mm.
But I work with the most amazing people. And we, it's not that it's not challenging, it's really challenging, but I think we all love delivering the best pictures and the best words our readers.
And what makes a destination magazine worthy?
I've slightly pivoted recently in the sense that I think as journalists, you're part traveller, you know, I'm part traveller and I'm part journalist. I'm part the, you know, the directive of a journalist is to find the something that's new or emerging.
Mm-hmm.
But I have found that recently to slightly jar as I travel the world and I go to, you know, far out deserts and tiny European cities. There are just so many of us travelling right now. That I feel really a responsibility to not just champion the new and to try and make sure that we're not just doing the same cookie cutter coffee shop is turning up everywhere from east to west. So at the moment, we're actually championing places that are resolutely themselves.
I'm also really curious to know how you work out what goes on your iconic covers. What's the kind of process for that?
Oh, that's such a sweat. We're in the middle of sweating about one now. And you want it to be arresting and startling, and it's very easy in travel to become cheesy and cliched. So we have these cover meetings every month. You choose a cover and then you take them down, and I go and see my boss and I go and see the head of circulation, and we go with my publisher and my art director, and we all look at this cover. But this funny thing happens to me is when I go down in the lift and I'm about to go into his office, I can see it in a different, I'm seeing it in a different way. So we would have spent weeks working on this cover, tweaking the tiny, the word goes here and you move that here and you should change the color of the, you know. And then I can see it fresh. And I had a moment yesterday and I was like, oh, I don't know if this is it. Anyway, and they were circumspect too. So now we're back at not square one, but we're experimenting with some others. Like, you know, it drives everyone mad, but I don't believe... The magazine always has to come first, and I always have to do the best that we can do.
But how do you hone in on an image? I mean, what is the process in itself?
So we try to go for something that is that you haven't seen before.
Yeah, something that's it's always so arresting.
Yes. But again, as I say, it's the hardest bit, and it's the sweatiest bit, and I'm judged as an editor in the UK how well I sell at newsstand, and at newsstand it's pretty much, it doesn't matter what's inside, people are either taken by that cover or not.
So it's a lot of pressure.
You know, one of the best selling cover we did practically of all time is a completely black cover, practically black, but with a tiny, tiny door into and also rather black. It was in a Riyadh in Morocco.
I remember it, yeah.
And so that, and that definitely didn't obey anyone's rules about, oh, it must be blue, it must be shiny, I must want to be there, it has to be light and bright. And so sometimes it's the one, but then again, you can't just, you know, you can't become stuck on doing something left field in the hope that you can't disappear up your own.
So chapter 3 then is the place where you learnt the most about yourself. Where would that be?
I think probably the most I've learned about myself is being with my children on trips.
Mm. And you have 3 kids?
I have 3 girls.
3 girls, lovely.
And sometimes my beloved, gorgeous husband, for example, obviously he's on these road trips with us, but he gets so mad with the mess in our RV and the chaos that we carry around us. But I have to say, when I'm with my girls and when we're on the move in that kind of way, I feel very whole.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a longtime listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
How is traveling with children compared to what before you didn't have children?
It's not so different for me. I mean, I used to stay in tiny places that cost like $10 a night. Now, little A-frame huts on a beach in Tiumen in Malaysia, or tiny little tree houses in Tulum that cost nothing. With the children, you have to make sure that there's space, there's basic stuff in situ. But on the other hand, we have lots of nice things and lots of nice pleasures in life, and I am very keen to show them that's not everything. That it's important to get rootsy and it's important to get down and dirty. And why I love traveling with them is because I make this stupid rule every time that's no tech, and then the children are really good at it and they throw away they're just like, that's fine. And I'm the one that's in a wild panic trying to edit a magazine from the middle of freaking Mumbai or something, or racing across some desert wherever it is, desperately trying to find Wi-Fi so I can send something to press. But actually, I love traveling with them because I can see through their eyes, and I can see them settle, and I can see them catch on to a different rhythm, and that gives me tremendous pleasure.
Chapter 4, I feel, is maybe the biggest question of all, which is your all-time favorite destination.
Gosh, I've got so many. I fell in love with Charleston recently.
What did you love about Charleston?
The people, actually. They just have a wicked sense of humor. It's always down to the people, actually. The Bahamas, where I spent a lot of time when I was little, my parents had a house there, and I love the Bahamians. India, I didn't go till I was older, and then I was just blown away, as everyone is. Everyone is just all involved in India, but again, it's the Indians because they're so incredibly funny.
When you first went to India, where was it in India that you loved in particular? So vast.
Funnily enough, actually, the first place I went to in India was Kerala when I was younger. And Kerala just, you know, lulled me into its beautiful kind of swaying palms and rice boats and backwaters. And that was gorgeous. But it was later when I went to Rajasthan that I was just... I felt my kind of pupils dilating. And funny enough, I took my children. When my husband hadn't been, and I was so excited to show them. And on the first drive, we'd, you know, had a long plane ride, and then I think we were driving like 6 hours to Udaipur or Jaipur, and my middle daughter, she just stretched her arms above her head and she said, "Oh, mama," she was just looking outside of the window and the cows on the chaos, and she said, "Oh, mama, I feel so alive." And I think it's so vigorous.
And how about your favorite hotel? Do you have a favorite?
Oh, so many at different times in different places. I remember going as a child to the Cala de Volpi in Sardinia. And a waiter showing us how to peel a peach in one piece and kind of cutting off the bottom in a very slither-like fashion and then massaging that kind of fuzzy skin off the top of it and that feeling like magic. Nowadays, I've had lots of fun times at Amila in the Maldives. I have a very wide family and a very multi-generational family and a very party-loving family. Mm-hmm. And my nieces and I and my kids and tons of friends of us have spent a lot of time at Amila. So I always think of it so fondly. Ascensia in Mexico is such a happy place for me. It used to be owned by a kind of Italian principessa, and is now being taken over by a lovely man, and has the most beautiful stretch of beach.
Where in Mexico is it?
It's just down the road from Tulum, and Tulum is a place that I know gets a very bad rap nowadays. And I think probably if you go at Christmas and New Year, it is probably teeming with too many people. But I first went many decades ago, and did nothing but kind of lie in a hammock and eat coconuts and swim in the sea. And then I took my family, and we lived in a little treehouse. And we had she was called the butler, which is hilarious because she was like 19 and had a very, very tiny skirt and a machete. And she didn't do an enormous amount, but we didn't really need her to, because she would just bring fresh mango every day and a bottle of tequila. And
that's all you needed.
That was the alpha and omega of her duties. But Ascensia, funnily enough, is further down the road, and it's more on its own and it's more considered. But that always brings back special memories. And then I probably have not one but two favorite hotels in Paris. The Bristol, I stay in for most Paris Fashion Weeks, and the staff there are so remarkable, and it smells delicious. Sometimes the best hotels, I think, are more than the sum of their parts. Like the Mercer in New York, a lot of André Bellage's hotels, actually, I think if you break them down, it doesn't really all make sense. But somehow the ones, and if you break the Bristol down, it doesn't really make sense. You walk straight into a kind of strange kind of arched room, but it's kind of arched the wrong way. And yet it has charisma. Mm-hmm. And then the other one in the city that I love so much is La Réserve, which is in an old building. It's very sumptuously done. It's like someone's private house, but it's very decadent and joyful. And between those two places during Paris, we always have lots of family, lots of friends, and lots of very beautiful Parisian times.
Lots of happy memories.
Yes, indeed.
So chapter 5 is your hidden gem. What would that be?
I don't know what's happened to this island in Honduras. I lived in a little... it was like a house on stilts, and there's a room that was at the bottom of the house on stilts. It was the kind of normally for the person who looked after the pigs. So I was surrounded by pigs and piglets, and I was in this kind of very sparse white room. And the only thing in this room was a huge anthology. It was like the complete work of Dickens. And the complete work of Dickens is sizable tome by anyone's standards.
I love that, that you're in the middle of Central America and there's a tome of Dickens.
Yes, very, it reminded me very much of Evelyn Waugh's A Handful of Dust, which is exactly what happens to the kind of hero in that, or the protagonist in that story. And there would be vast cockroaches wandering around at night, and I would whack them with this book of Dickens. But it also, I had like amazing adventures. I met up with all sorts of people and went night diving for the first time, which was astonishing. And I remember falling wildly in love with an octopus, which disappeared through the rocks like mercury and changed into a million colours. And I'd never seen anything so astonishing. I don't know what's happened to that island now. I pray it's not covered in hotels with infinity pools.
Well, speaking of which then, I wondered, when it comes to hidden gems, are you sometimes a bit loath to promote them in the magazine if there's someone that you think is particularly kind of special or dear to you?
I used to feel, about 2 years ago, I thought it was my responsibility to tell everyone about my hidden gem.
Mm-hmm.
Now I feel that some things need to be sacred, and I also feel that the places that we should be visiting now are the ones that haven't been fiddled with by people like me and haven't been muddled with and haven't been all over Instagram and aren't covered in Airbnbs. So I feel like where we should go and what we should be doing henceforth is probably the completely random cities whose names you can't pronounce that are resolutely themselves.
Mm. And are there any destinations that you're tipping as the next big thing, conversely, for next year?
Well, I just read actually a proof on Belgrade. And actually, it was a rather lovely tale by a girl who'd gone there to report on the war many years ago, and then she ended up falling in love with a Serbian, and they got married. And I think Belgrade is, lots of those Balkan capitals have kind of galvanized themselves and their kind of design vigor and their craftsmanship and stuff. But what I really liked about this story is we kind of wholeheartedly drilled down on the bits that were still very Soviet.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unfashionable furniture, and it's unfashionable hotel rooms, and it's unfashionable aesthetic, because that's and it's kind of strange marmalade light. I felt that we shouldn't always be trying to pluck all these pretty things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We should be going a bit deeper.
Yeah. And chapter 6 is the place that you'd never go back to. Is there a place that you remember for the wrong reasons?
It's funny that in a way it was kind of a classic worst of times, best of times, in the sense that I would never go back, nor could you ever go back, but because it was kind of Soviet Russia pre-Glasnost. And despite the fact that I'm poking fun at my tiny, tiny boarding school, they took us on a very progressive trip to Russia when we were 17. And I remember flying over Russia and looking out the window. I mean, I'm obsessed by looking out of plane windows at all times. I'm always astonished.
Always getting a window seat.
Yes, always. I pretend it's got something to do with my sore neck. But actually, it's because I'm being greedy and I want to suck up. I want to suck up the view. And I remember flying over Russia and just being amazed. And then, you know, we landed and we stayed in kind of, you know, state-sanctioned hotels. I remember we had meatballs for breakfast, lunch and supper. And we'd wander the streets, these huge, wide, open streets with people still queuing for bread. And we took barrows. I mean, literally, we took barrows to swap for, you know, rabbit hats. And then we would sneak out at night to meet up with all these boys who lived in these tiny houses who had learnt English. It sounds like I'm making this up now. They'd learnt English by listening to kind of black market Frank Sinatra records. So they talked in very strange vernaculars and it was mesmerised. We were mesmerised by each other. So I literally couldn't go back there and wouldn't be able to go back there because I don't think it exists anymore.
Fantastic. So then chapter 7 is your next big adventure. What's next on the cards?
I'm going to Egypt with my stepmother. My stepmother is a very generous host, and she takes my stepbrother and stepsister and I and our many, many children on these grand and brilliant and proper trips. So Egypt, I think, will be something spectacular.
Where in Egypt are you travelling?
All over.
Yeah.
I'm slightly nervous about the profusion of ruins and the age of the offspring. But you know, I used to do this as a child, and I don't remember necessarily Ephesus, and I don't necessarily... Actually, I do remember Leptis Magna. I remember feeling Leptis Magna very much as I could feel the living city of it, which was rather amazing. But they'll remember something else. They'll remember the smell of the stone, or they'll remember the meander of the Nile. They won't remember the history, but it all, you know, silts down and settles upon us and feeds us. So we'll see how that goes. And then I'm mad about trains. One of my favourite journeys is leaving London at night and taking the sleeper to Scotland. And I told my children that we were taking the sleeper to Scotland, and one of them burst into tears. She was just couldn't get over such a thing. And then we arrived at the train station. It was 9, and they were so tired, and they were little errand. And there was he looked like kind of Toad of Toad Hall, and he was wearing a kind of tweed 3-piece suit, and he was so smart and glamorous. And we got on the train, and we, you know, got into our position, and they couldn't get over the beds that lever up and down. Yeah. And I'm obsessed by the sheets. They're kind of dry as biscuits, and yet somehow there's nothing more nourishing. And then beautiful Toad of Toad Hall said, "And what would you want for breakfast? You know, tea or coffee, and kind of cake." And we all were just. We're so excited, and then you just go to sleep in that rattle and rattle of the train, and then however many hours you wake up in that unbelievably cold, crisp dawn, but pre-dawn, so it's still dark, and you're in a tiny, tiny station in the middle of nowhere, and we have friends that we stay with, and they've always left a Land Rover, which is kind of missing seats and brakes and windows, and we climb into the Land Rover and then bush, and then you're driving, and you're driving through them. Through the highlands and the glory, and everyone is shocked awake in the best possible
way. Magnificent. Do you see train travel as being a major travel trend for the future?
Completely. I think what Belmont do with their trains. I think what we just did a piece about Amtrak. From New York, a journey from New York to San Francisco. I think trains will become a big part of our conversation going forward, and I'm thrilled about it, because that's not just from a protecting the climate point of view, but they're an extraordinary way to see the world as it literally shoots past you. And then combined with that, how much more respectful they are of the earth.
Absolutely. Can't believe we're on to chapter 8 then, and that is, what's at the top of your travel wish list?
Japan. I've never been to Japan.
Oh, wow.
Sometimes I lie, because there'll be people who come in for a meeting and they'll talk about somewhere that's very well known and well trodden, and I haven't been there, and I pretend that I have. It's awful. And I do that in life. I remember having an interview for a job, and there was a woman who said that she had a kind of an old editor, and she said she had a Rottweiler, a certain type of dog, and I pretended that I did too. I don't know why I think this would ingratiate me with people. But I'm trying to stop lying, and I'm trying to actually go to Japan rather than fibbing about it. And I remember my niece saying to me that she remembers one particular. She said, "The baths run so slowly there." And she said, "There's something about the slowness of the filling of the bath and the slowness of the pouring of the tea." She said, "It's just, you know, brings everything down, and the temperature in your system just drops." And of course, it's many parts of it, huge, thriving metropolises. But I've longed to get out to the Ruikens and the countryside, and for that respect for ritual, I long to witness that.
Mm. Fantastic. Well, Melinda Stevens, those were your travel diaries. What a pleasure. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Well, that was Melinda Stevens, the editor-in-chief of Condé Nast Traveller magazine here in the UK and in the US. The magazine is, of course, available in all good newsagents and is a fabulous read. If you've enjoyed what you've heard today, then please hit subscribe and leave a review. And I'd love to hear from you. You can also find me on Instagram at Holly Rubenstein. All that's left to say is thank you so much for listening, and I'll speak to you next time. Today's episode is supported by Airbnb, and what a great partnership. If you're a long-time listener of the Travel Diaries, you probably know that we love to put our home on Airbnb when we're traveling. Like last autumn when we took the family to Puglia, we put our house on Airbnb when otherwise it would just be sitting empty, which meant that we earned some extra money that went towards our flights and maybe some souvenirs too. Hosting on Airbnb for us is also a family affair. My mum is an Airbnb superhost. She regularly has guests stay in her little chalet in her garden. And my dad, who lives in France, has his home on Airbnb so that when he comes back to visit, he is earning some extra money while he's away. My dad is 80 and he only started hosting on Airbnb a couple of years ago. So hopefully that shows you how straightforward the whole experience is. He found it so easy to list his house that I think he's got all his pals signing up now too. And it really is straightforward. You can choose whether you want to rent out your entire home or just some rooms. Alex and I, for example, list our spare bedroom and that works really well for us. So if you have a trip coming up and you want to earn some extra money while you're away, your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.co.uk/host. That's airbnb.co.uk/host. Thank you to Airbnb.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.